All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Robert N. Davis presiding. All what business before this court shall adhere and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good morning. Before I call the case, I have a few items to share with you all. Welcome here. As many of you may know, this year we are celebrating the 30th anniversary of the creation of this wonderful court. On November 18th of 1988, President Ronald Reagan signed into law the Veterans Judicial Review Act, creating the United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims, at that time named the United States Court of Veterans Appeals. Passage of that law was the culmination of decades-long efforts to secure judicial review for veterans. That stroke of the pen was momentous. It set into motion the creation of the court where America's veterans, for the first time in history, were afforded the right to contest decisions denying their veterans' benefits claims to an independent judicial tribunal. 8 months later, in July of 1989, Chief Judge Frank Nebaker was commissioned as the court's first chief judge, and on October 16, 1989, Chief Justice William Rehnquist swore in two additional judges, Judges Ken Kramer and Jack Farley, and thereby established a quorum that allowed the court to commence operations. And you all here are here at a historic time in the court's development. Today, we announce another historic event in our court's maturation and evolutionary path. We are pleased to announce, beginning today, with the upcoming oral argument in a few moments, live streaming of all of our oral arguments on our USCAVC YouTube channel. As the youngest federal court and one with national jurisdiction, we have always made significant efforts to be transparent, to educate, and to be accessible to the public at large. We believe live streaming our oral arguments will bring a new level of transparency on how this court operates, and greater education and accessibility beyond Washington, D.C., to millions of veterans, advocates, and citizens around the country. So you all are on TV. I'd also like to extend our most heartfelt welcome to a group of new attorneys and paralegals from the Department of Veterans Affairs as you join us in this very noble mission at the intersection of law, medicine, and war. I look forward to speaking with you briefly after oral argument, and I will see if my colleagues on the bench today would like to join me. Now to the business at hand. I'm Chief Judge Davis. To my right is Judge Allen. To my left is Judge Meredith. We are here today in the matter of Casey against Wilkie, docket number 18-1051. To consider whether a one-time payment is an erroneous award, whether the overpayment debt is a reduction to the award, and whether the overpayment was solely the result of administrative error. Would counsel for both parties please note your appearance for the record? Welcome. Let me note for the record that Ms. Grunberg was a lawyer in my chambers more than 2.5 years ago, and before I became chief judge, I have considered her appearance today and will have no problems being fair and impartial. Thank you. Are both parties ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Very good. Each party will have 30 minutes to present your respective arguments. Counsel for the appellant, do you wish to reserve a portion of your time for rebuttal? 5 minutes. Thank you. You may proceed. Ms. Ralston, let me start with a question. Why would your client not simply write a check to the government for an overpayment?
Well, I think under the circumstances of this case, and considering the multiple errors that VA made, that it should not be her burden to have to correct that mistake and issue a check to the government.
Was there a fee agreement with the attorney?
Yes, sir, there was.
And what did that fee agreement provide?
The fee agreement did provide that we would be entitled to 20% of the retroactive award, and that if that amount were not withheld by VA, that she could pay that directly.
So that amount was not withheld by VA, and she did not pay it directly?
It was not. But the issue in this case is not so much the payment of her attorney's fees, but the fact that here the VA made a series of mistakes, and then as a result of that mistakes, and more than a year after the erroneous payment was made to her, VA is now trying to come back and recoup that over erroneously paid amount out of her DIC benefit.
When did counsel find out that a mistake had been made?
That information obviously is not a part of the record, but we can.
That's why I asked the question.
No, but we can say that it was certainly many months after the erroneous payment had been made.
So how can that be? I know it's been well, you don't know this, but it's been a very long time since I practiced law. I used to ride the dinosaur to work. Let's put it that way. But I got to tell you, I would know if I was supposed to get a roughly $20,000 receivable and it wasn't there. That just seems like an odd part of this whole thing to me.
I can certainly appreciate that. And again, obviously this information is not in the record, but we were in communication with VA following the issuance of decision, and the contact logs that we have available for the file certainly show that VA had informed us that it was something that they were working on. And so this was not something that we expected. They were not going to be withholding or not handling the attorney fee matter.
So have you, this is a basic question, have you received any attorney fee from either the government or your client?
We have at this point been paid those fees, and that's why we assert that the issue in this case isn't about our payment of the fees.
But by whom? Who paid you?
By VA.
But so VA paid you?
Ultimately, yes. They did pay the fees, and then they created an overpayment and recouped the payment from the widow's DSC benefits.
Did you say they recouped or are recouping?
I believe they've completely recouped.
I see. Okay.
So what are you, so the result of ruling in favor of your client is overpayment, right? I mean, in other words, the government will pay twice for something it should only have paid once for now because they paid you.
Have paid, but what we're saying is that in a situation where there again where there were a series of mistakes, our client did not receive clear notice about the amount that she was actually owed. The VA, despite the notations in the file that it should be reviewed for attorney's fees, they were aware of the fact that an attorney was present, and they still failed to do the withholding, and she was not notified of this error for a considerable amount of time following the actual decision. And under those circumstances, that Congress intended that VA should bear the burden of their mistakes, and that should not be passed on to the claimant. And so this, again, this is not about the payment of our fees, but this is about when you have a widow who's in her 70s and the VA has made these serious mistakes and that's culminated in an erroneous award, whether it's appropriate to pass that burden of knowing what the mistake was and resolving the issue onto the claimant.
Is there any potential is there any potential ethical issue here? In other words, you've been paid, right? If you prevail today, then assuming the VA will then write another check back to the widow, the appellant. But I can pretty much guess that VA is not going to just sit there and pay twice for what it could only should only pay once for. And if we rule there, then of course they're going to be coming after you to get the fee back from you somehow. It would seem to me in the abstract that would not be something where you would want to be the person representing this, because if you win, you may end up losing the $18,000. You see what I mean? That's a very odd thing here.
You can certainly appreciate what you're saying. I think that the way that we view this is, again, it's not so much how and by whom that we're paid. The issue is, under this circumstance, is it something that the VA, when their own regulations provide for this type of withholding, and there's a set of instructions that they're supposed to follow when handling these cases, if they're not issuing the notice, if they're not following their own instructions, and they're not complying with the regulation to withhold the fees in that circumstance, then is it appropriate to go after the widow of a veteran and seek to be repaid for a mistake that they made?
Ms. Ralston, you referred to this award as erroneous. Is this really an erroneous award? As I understand it, the award amount, there's no dispute over the award amount, if I recall, something like $91,000. But this is a dispute over payment after that award, right?
Yep.
How can that be an erroneous award then?
Well, as this court has discussed in Dent, the term erroneous award contemplates many things. It's
yeah,
not
but
just
Dent that. Involves recurring payments. This is a one-time payment.
No, this is a one-time payment, but I don't think that that changes the discussion and the legislative history of this particular statute, and that it was intended to contemplate not just the initial award, which you're correct, we are not challenging. What we are challenging is that there was an erroneous action that was predicated upon a misunderstanding of law, and that exact type of erroneous action is contemplated and was intended by Congress to be.
But you've substituted the word action. I mean, clearly this was a whoops moment for the VA, right? I mean, it made a mistake. But the question is, as a technical matter, was the award erroneous? Because it was to the penny, what, $91,066, I think, was the amount. But it was exactly correct in terms of the amount of accrued benefits owing to the deceased veteran, right? And so. No question VA's action was incorrect because it distributed that money, divided that money incorrectly, but the award of $91,066 was correct.
Again, we are not challenging that the initial award itself at that amount was incorrect, but as discussed in Dent, the award itself, the term award, encompasses not just the initial award, not just where they determined the amount of retroactive benefits to which the claimant was entitled, but also any erroneous payments or erroneous actions that stem from that.
Yeah, but here, it was both, you know, to use the old phrase, the alpha and the omega. It was the beginning and the end. In Dent, it wasn't. The award was the beginning, and the recurring payments continued on. Here, the moment of the award was the beginning and the end of the accrued benefits award, right? There was nothing else to happen.
With all due respect, we disagree, because following the initial award, there was a subsequent payment that was made, and it was that action that was erroneous.
The subsequent payment, you mean?
The payment of the award, the amount that was owed. In terms of calculating the retroactive benefit, that amount was correct, but what was actually the erroneous payment that was made to appellant was not in the correct.
So you're saying that the two things were the letter saying you get $91,000 and then the giving of the $91,000? Is that what you mean by the payment?
What we're saying is that there's kind of a series of missteps there. I mean, there is the initial award, which is the total retroactive amount that was due at the time of the veteran's death. But then there's also this erroneous action, which is where the payment that was made was not the amount that was actually due to appellant. And so there's a separate action that's involved there, and that's incorrect. I mean, the error itself, the actual error, did not occur until at the time that payment was made.
Okay.
So under 5112, the statute you're arguing is applicable here, we wouldn't get to the analysis about whether there was an erroneous award unless there's some kind of reduction at issue. Here, you're contending in your initial briefing that the reduction was lowering of the DIC monthly payments in order to recoup the overpayment to the surviving spouse. Did the appellant raise that argument below through current counsel's firm?
You'll have to forgive me, but I do believe that the issue regarding the whether or not there was a reduction present was raised in the brief to the board. I believe
that. But that it was the DIC at issue, not the accrued benefits.
I don't recall if they specified whether it was DIC.
If it wasn't raised below, is that something we should be addressing now?
I certainly believe that the issue regarding reduction was raised below, and obviously that's been briefed at the before the court. So I think it's something that's appropriate for the court to address here.
So once the overpayment, I think the chief started out this, the surviving spouse had an option. She could have written a check either to VA or the attorney to pay off this debt. In that case, the DIC monthly payments moving forward would not have been reduced. So in that circumstance, would there be a reduction that would get us to look at 5112?
We submit that there's still a reduction in a retroactive sense, because in order for VA to go back and correct the erroneous payment, there would be a reduction in the amount that would actually be paid to her. However, because...
So in the accrued benefits payment, not in the DIC?
It would be a reduction of the payment, right? That would be the amount that they could reduce, that instead of her receiving the $91,000, that the amount that she should have been paid would have been less the withholdings.
But that amount would have been, if they had properly sent the payments, that money would have been reduced from the $91,000 under the fee agreement. How does that constitute a reduction within the context of 5112?
Well, I think that there's nothing in the language of the statute of regulation that suggests that the reduction or discontinuance has to be in a future or ongoing payment. And I certainly think that there is a suggestion in how the VA even applies this, that it can happen retroactively. In the M21 manual, there's an example that's provided about how a discontinuance where a veteran has a child but does not ask for the child to be added as a dependent until many years later, and the VA, when that request is made, VA subsequently adds the dependent to the award as the date that the dependent was born. In that scenario, VA acknowledges that there's administrative error, and it retroactively discontinues the effective date for that award. That does not affect the ongoing monthly payment, and there's still a retroactive discontinuance. And so in this case as well, they would be able to retroactively reduce the payment that was made to Ms. Casey, even though that would not affect her ongoing benefit.
So if your reading of this statute is correct, of 5112, ultimately no overpayment or debt would be created because you'd say it was solely VA's error. So in that case, there would be no reduction. If under your reading, there would be no debt and no reduction of the DIC payments. Is that sort of a circular argument that this statute should apply?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe that it's circular. I think what we're saying is that there would be a reduction to the amount that Ms. Casey.
No, if you're successful in your arguments, then no reduction takes place and no debt is created.
Then there would be a reduction, but the effective date of that reduction would be the date of the last erroneous payment. So you're correct in that there would be no overpayment that was created, but that's primarily because the reason for that overpayment was the result of VA error. If the facts of this case...
There's no debt created, but what's the reduction?
The reduction would be in the initial payment that was made to her. I mean, I understand that it may not reduce, it may not result in a reduction actually to the appellant, but that's exactly what the statute is intended to do, where there's a situation where because there's a result of VA error, even though there may be a discontinuance of some benefit for a period of time, that doesn't result in the amount of money that's paid to the claimant because that error was the result of sole administrative error. If the facts of this case were different, and if Ms. Casey had been provided with notice of the actual amount that she was supposed to receive, then in that circumstance, VA could go back and retroactively reduce the payment that was made to her. But because she had some knowledge of the situation, then they could also create an overpayment and then subsequently recoup the benefits, the amount overpaid. Excuse me. We believe that this case involves a question of whether claimants, such as widows and dependent children and other recipients of one-time payments, are to be afforded protection in situations where an erroneous payment is made solely as a result of VA administrative error. This case presents a situation where Ms. Casey was not provided with clear notice about the amount that she was to receive. She was then paid more than she was owed, and that she was misled regarding her entitlement to that amount for a considerable amount of time following when payment was made.
Ms. Ralston, on October 15th of 2014, as I understand it, the department notified Mrs. Casey that it had failed to withhold attorney fees, and the overpayment was in the amount of $18,213.20. In September of 2015, Mrs. Casey filed a notice of disagreement disputing the creation of the overpayment debt. So there was a significant amount of time, almost a year, where your client had the opportunity to resolve this situation. Yes?
There was a considerable amount of time between the time she was notified of it and the time that an appeal was initiated. However, there was also an even more considerable amount of time between the payment that was made and her notice of it. And I think that's one of the factors here for consideration is the delay between the time that she was formally notified of the overpayment. I mean, again, we're talking about a widow with a limited income, and she's received this money, and now more than a year later, VA is coming back, and they're trying to take a portion of that from her. We are not arguing that simply because VA overpaid Ms. Casey that she should get to keep the excess at VA's expense. Rather, we are arguing that where VA makes multiple mistakes in the payment of a benefit, and those mistakes result in an overpayment without the claimant's knowledge or fault, that Congress intended VA to bear the burden of those mistakes. This case hinges on whether the court agrees that Section 5112B10 and 38 CFR 3.500B2 apply to an award that consists of a single accrued benefit payment, and Ms. Casey submits it does. Importantly, Ms. Casey also submits that if the court is to adopt the approach that the Secretary suggested, then it would limit the recipients of a one-time payment to their defense. They would only be able to raise a request of an overpayment, and that is despite the fact that the overpayment was made solely as a result of VA administrative error.
But wasn't the whole sort of thrust behind the statute and regulation here that talk about timing of when the reduction will begin, for lack of a better way to put it, the idea that Congress and the agency were trying to essentially allow a benefit recipient whose benefits are being reduced or discontinued essentially time to adjust? Right, they have to have. We got to figure out when it's going to start because they've been getting something, and now that's going to change. And so we need to give them some time as to when this is going to happen. That just doesn't apply in the same way to a one-time lump sum payment.
It doesn't, but I believe the portion of the statute that you're referring to is subsection B6, and that statute deals with when there's been a change in the law, or when there's been a change such that the beneficiary would be aware of the fact that they may not be entitled to that benefit. And that's not the facts of this case. In 10.
Well, that's true, but here, I mean, I remember when I first looked at this case, when it came to me, and I went and looked at the statute and regulation and was struck by the titles of these sections, which is all about timing. But the timing question just is simply irrelevant in a one-time payment because there's only one time.
There may be one time in terms of the payment, but I don't think that the statute, the language of the statute, or even the intent was to limit the ability to reduce either retroactively, to have that reduction apply retroactively to prior to when the erroneous payment was made, or in the future with regards to a reduction or discontinuance of ongoing benefits. I don't think there's anything in the language of the statute that limits it to be applied that way, that limits its application.
What if she wasn't receiving DIC payments and the same thing happened with the accrued benefits? Would your argument be exactly the same?
I think you raise, well, I'm sorry, would you mind repeating the question?
Sure. Assume that she wasn't entitled for some reason to DIC benefits, so she did not have a continuing stream of payments, okay? But the exact same VA error happened, which is her award was $91,066, should have been subtracted 20% of that to be paid to your firm directly. VA made the same mistake, sent her a check for $91,000. Then they realize, whoops, we made a mistake, and they create an overpayment. Would your argument be the same, or does your argument rely on the fact that VA is then taking the recoupment out of a stream of other VA benefits?
I don't believe that there's anything in the statute or in our argument that relies upon the fact that there is a recurrent ongoing benefit. I think that it would still, the VA would still be able, if in the event there was an erroneous payment, to retroactively reduce that payment and then seek, if there was no administrative error, if there was some fault of the claimant.
So then let me stop you then. Okay, so then for analytical purposes, we can forget the fact that this is taken out of an ongoing stream of DIC payments, because you said your argument would be exactly the same if there were no such benefit, right?
I don't believe it is necessary for there to be a recurring ongoing benefit in order for the statute to apply.
Okay, so then we are actually back to Judge Meredith's question, right? Because you then have to say that there's a reduction in benefits with respect to the accrued benefits claim. And that is a very hard argument to get. And maybe I'm mischaracterizing what Judge Meredith said, but I mean, that's how I understood it to be. It's hard to characterize that as a reduction.
A reduction in the amount that was initially paid to the claimant?
Well, but it's a reduction in the benefit, right? I mean, her benefit was exactly $91,000 as a gross matter, right?
The initial award was in the $91,000. But again, it's not just about the initial award. There's also any subsequent payment that stems from that award. And in this case, it was the subsequent payment where the error was made. So if the VA...
Yes, but still, how is that a reduction? First of all, and I'm sure this is me, I do not follow at all this point about the letter and then the check coming being significant that those two things didn't happen simultaneously. But leave that aside, I'm still struggling with how that could be a reduction in a benefit, because she ends up getting exactly what she should have gotten.
She was not... The amount that she was actually paid is not the amount that she was actually owed.
Right. She was paid more.
Correct.
Right? So she was paid more. If we then paid her what she should have been paid, it's just difficult to construe that as a reduction in benefits, because she's getting exactly what she should have gotten.
She was paid the amount that she was initially awarded, but the amount that she should have actually been paid, there is a difference there. And what VA did was they erroneously paid her that benefit, and the reduction would occur in the amount that should have been paid to her and the amount that was paid to her. I mean, there would be a retroactive reduction in that circumstance.
So, Ms. Ralston, what would you like this court to do?
What we would like this court to do is to find that Congress intended for the statute to apply in a circumstance where, with no knowledge or fault of the claimant, VA makes a series of mistakes that results in an erroneous payment, and that in this very limited circumstance, that an overpayment cannot be created.
But in this situation, as I understand it, the overpayment has been recouped from your client by the government. Is that correct? So there is no money left on the table at the moment, as I understand it.
There is not, but she was also, I I mean, she had almost $20,000 that was taken from her, which we believe was not fair.
From her DIC benefits?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Okay. Very good.
We believe that the way the secretary asked the court to apply this statute would result in a group of people that are left unprotected simply because they were the recipient of a one-time payment. And there's nothing in the legislative history which demonstrates that Congress intended to distinguish between recipients of a one-time payment and recipients of an ongoing monthly benefit. And if the statute is read as creating this distinction, then that means that the recipients of a one-time payment, their only recourse is to request waiver, which is a much more complex analysis, and which brings in other factors for consideration and does not explicitly afford protection for situations involving sole administrative error. So by finding the statute does not apply to a one-time payment, then someone who, within a situation where there is administrative error, sole administrative error, simply because they received a one-time payment, they're not going to be afforded protection under this statute. They would only be able to raise a waiver argument. And there's nothing in the considerations for waiver that provides that analysis stops in the event that there's sole administrative error.
But there is a provision for waiver, correct, that could have been pursued, no?
Yes, Your Honor.
And isn't there still a, is it 503 that could also be requested on equitable appeal to the secretary?
Yes, Your Honor. We believe that's not the appropriate remedy or relief to seek in this case, though, because the error is so clear. And by requesting waiver, we would be subjecting the appellant to other considerations. Again, under waiver, while there is a consideration for administrative error or this balancing of faults, there's also a tremendous amount of, or there are several other considerations as well, such as undue hardship and things such of that nature. And that shouldn't be a factor in a situation where, again, the erroneous payment was the sole result of VA administrative error.
Okay. Any questions? Any other questions? Okay. Thank you. Ms. Gronberg?
Good morning, Chief Judge Davis, and may it please the court.
Let me start with a question. Why didn't the VA get this right the first time? Why were there mistakes in the payment of the amount?
Pardon me, Your Honor, why didn't VA?
Right. Why didn't VA get this right the first time?
Your Honor, VA did not distribute the money to two payees as it should have because of the fee agreement and under statutory section 5904. The record shows that a VA employee did not notice or input that there was or should have been the attorney fee withholding. However, as Judge Allen did indicate, the amount of the award was approximately $91,000, and that's what was actually paid to the appellant. And so it's not an erroneous award. Rather, it was a distribution issue, which...
Before you get into the law, which I like the law, but I sort of have a policy question. So I think we all agree, and I think the VA has apologized, that it was a mistake, right? They should have taken 20% of 91,000 and paid it to the lawyer and paid just the 72,000 to the claimant, right? You agree with me on that?
Yes, that was a distribution mistake, Your Honor.
Right. I know. You're coming back to the law, the distribution. But leave that aside. Well, right now what I'm saying is, you know, when the chief judge asked you how did this happen, the answer is we're humans and we make mistakes, right? So, and that's what VA said, it's a mistake. Great. Is there a policy for when you find out you made a mistake like this, what the government actually did here is by then taking sort of affirmative action, meaning you send her a letter, you say we should have paid you less, and then you pay the attorneys. VA made a conscious choice to pay the attorneys. You have injected the big bureaucratic nose into this dispute, right? In other words, VA shouldn't make mistakes like this. When they do, though, is there a policy that says we're going to get our nose in there? Or why didn't the VA just say, listen, hey, attorney, we should have paid you. Our bad. We understand by the fee agreement, you've now got a choice. You can write this off. You can try to pursue some action against us if you want, or you can sue your client, and it's a business decision for you. We should have paid you, but we didn't. Right? That would have been, it seems to me, a way for the government to sort of stand back a little bit. Do you have a policy that says we will affirmatively do this?
Your Honor, it is not a policy, but case law and statute requires that to occur. As the Federal Circuit stated in Snyder, VA is, there's a mandatory requirement that when there's a fee agreement under statutory section 5904 that VA pay the attorney according to the fee agreement if it is valid. And so that's why VA paid the attorney in this case.
So you read Snyder as imposing a legal obligation on VA to do what it did here? And I'm not suggesting you're necessarily wrong. I'm just suggesting that even if the government were to prevail here, if I were writing an opinion, I'd want to look at Snyder, because if it doesn't say that, then VA should at least know that it's making a choice to do this, right?
Your Honor, I believe that in Snyder, the Federal Circuit stated that the withholding when there is a fee agreement and under 5904 should be remitted by VA.
Well, and I certainly agree with that to the extent that if you have a fee agreement on file and it's proper, then VA doesn't have a discretionary choice whether to pay the lawyer or not. I'm not sure that answers the question that if VA lets the horse out of the barn, so to speak, that it has to go back and do what it necessarily did here.
Your Honor, VA did inform appellant in October 2014 that it would propose the overpayment and explained to her in that letter that she could pay the attorney and provide information to VA showing that she had paid, and she never responded to that, which is why in 2015 VA created the overpayment.
When did the VA pay the attorney?
Your Honor, it's not clear from the record when that occurred. There is a 2016 letter from the attorney, which is not part of the record of proceedings with leave, but it states that the attorney was paid, and opposing counsel that it was paid. I'm not sure when it occurred.
And do you know what led to, kind of picking up on Judge Allen's question, what led to the VA making the decision subsequently after having paid the award? What led to the VA paying the attorney?
Well, I believe because the appellant did not inform VA that the attorney had been paid, VA, pursuant to Snyder, the fee agreement on file in 1504, paid the attorney. But I do think the threshold question here, which this court has recognized previously, is really in whether statutory section 5112 applies is, has there been a reduction or a discontinuance? And when there's a one-time payment that is made, there is no reduction or discontinuance, so 5112 doesn't apply. As Judge Allen noted, the statutory section is titled effective dates of reductions or discontinuance, and both subsections A and B use that phrase. And contrary to what appellant has argued, the court should look at the statute as a whole. As this court stated in Dent, it should be viewed as a harmonious whole. So we're not only looking at the term erroneous award in B10. We should look at other parts of subsection B, and several of those parts discuss changes in income and circumstances in law, and those types of changes apply to a running award, which is why 5112 makes sense and has been applied where there's a running award, such as in Dent and Jordan, but where no reduction has occurred, such as in O'Connell, 5112 would not apply.
So let me just, let's just assume for a second that there's an erroneous award here, right? In other words, it's a mistake. Let's just assume that I know you don't, but let's just assume it. What about the appellant's argument that says if we adopt the reading that a one-time payment could never be subject to these sections, the statute and regulation, that it sort of leaves that group of people unprotected with respect to an error that was solely the fault of VA? Let's assume that, right?
Your Honor, respectfully, we disagree, because 5314 has a waiver exception. And so in considering whether waiver of a debt should occur, We do consider fault of VA. That's one of the factors in the equity and good conscience test.
So, but in theory, right, a person who's got a running award that we all agree this section applies to, right?
Yes,
they got a running award. They could get proverbially two bites at the apple to get out from under a discontinuance, right? Because they could use these statutes and regulations, but they could also use the general waiver, right? They could ask for a waiver even if the requirements of this statute weren't met, right?
Correct, Your Honor. And I think that if we look to Senate Report 2042, you can see why that there should be two bites for when there's a running award. And that's because Congress wanted to provide advance notice to beneficiaries that payments would be diminished. So when there's a running award, that's important because you would want them to adjust to diminished expectations and adjust to a change of what they have been receiving. Whereas if there's a one-time payment, there is no adjustment period, but you can still apply for a waiver if you do think that there is a component that it is against equity and good conscience. So turning to the legislative history again, it does discuss perpetuation of inaction or changes in circumstance, and the Secretary submits that those types of factors are relevant for running awards. And for the argument that 5112 or Regulatory Section 3.500 should apply to future unrelated payments, question 4 of the court's briefing order, we submit that there is already a specific statute that applies and that statute should control, and that's 5314. Under statutory section 5314, it states that the Secretary shall deduct indebtedness from future payments, and it does include that waiver exception. So the mandatory language and the waiver exception would be rendered superfluous if 5112 also applied to deductions of future unrelated payments, and that's not what Congress intended. When you look to the Senate report in the section discussing B-9 specifically, Congress stated that overpayments under B-9 would be subject to recovery unless waived. And when B-10 applied, there would be no overpayment created requiring recovery. And appellant's supplemental response appears to recognize how these two statutes work in different ways, but somewhat together. 5112 would apply for effective dates, and therefore it would come into play for considering debt validity. When there is a debt, that's when we turn to 5314, and that controls the collection. And that's why in Dent, after this court stated that the debt was valid in that case, the court also stated that it would be subject to recovery. If this court does determine that a one-time payment is subject to 5112, we would also submit that the payment here was not erroneous. As noted previously, the initial award was correct. It was approximately $91,000, and there's no dispute as to that point, and that's what was paid.
So, but what do we do with the fact that the board seems to have used the phrase that this was an erroneous award?
Your Honor, the primary part, or the first part of the board's decision, explained that 5112 didn't apply. And it also explained in the alternative, because appellant argued that below, that even if it did apply, that this was not an erroneous award, but it was just a distribution error. And that distribution, we agree that VA made a mistake when it didn't give the approximately $18,000 to opposing counsel. But what was actually paid matched the award.
So you submitted a supplemental notice recently withdrawing one of your arguments. I just want to make sure that I understand the full scope of that withdrawal. Are you no longer arguing that, and I realize it's well down the road, because we'd have to assume that the statute applies, that this is erroneous, that it's an award, that it's a reduction in discontinuance of benefits. We have to do a lot. But if we checked all those boxes, are you just taking totally off the table the entire issue of whether this was sole administrative error? Or are you just taking just something about the letter off?
We would not agree that this is sole administrative error. We agree that the board didn't adequately explain why it found that it was not sole administrative error, because the board did rely on the July 2013 notice letter and stated that appellant knew or should have known when she and her attorney received that letter that it wasn't withheld, and it relied on a portion of the M21. We agree with appellant's argument that the board didn't adequately explain its reliance on the portion of the M21 and how that related to the 2013 notice letter. But as you stated, that is far down the road, and we would submit that 5112 does not apply to a one-time payment.
Ms. Grunberg, let me ask you to put on your future thinking cap for a second and try to look at other cases like this that might be brought. Is there some of this seems to me to be definitional regarding award and what that includes, how broad or how specific the definition for award is. Other of it involves the statutory interpretation and the coverage under 5112 and 5314. So if you were in our seat, how would you correct the statute, the regulations, or the M21 to make a one-time payment like this not repeat the litigation process that we're going through now?
Could you perhaps rephrase the question? Do you mean in this case or in other cases?
If you were writing an opinion offering guidance to the bar, how would you offer that guidance? And would it include correcting legislative language or regulatory language?
I don't think the question is correcting any type of language, but in rather viewing what the statute says and what Congress intended. And I don't think the statute or the regulation apply to a one-time payment. So in looking to types of distribution errors that happened here, where there is a one-time payment, the court should direct that there is a provision that allows for waiver of an overpayment in those types of cases.
But does the statute expressly say it does not apply to a one-time payment?
Your Honor, it does not. But because of the terms, because there is the timing element and the terms reduction and discontinuance, the statute does appear to apply only to running awards, and it didn't apply it to a running award and discuss payments in that context.
Can you tell if Congress intended it to apply to one-time payments?
In O'Connell, the court explained how the Senate report and legislative history showed that this part of subsection B at issue there, B6, discussed advance notice and diminished expectations and adjustments, and that Senate report does explain why we would want to not perpetuate erroneous awards. And so when viewed in that context, I think that it is clear that Congress intended this to apply to running awards.
So just so I'm clear about this, because so you agree that the full amount has been recouped from appellant?
Your Honor, I'm not sure if it has been recouped. I know that the debt letter stated that the withholdings would begin in May 2015, and appellant did not submit an NOD until September 2015, so I believe it has started. I'm not sure if the entire amount has been recouped.
Okay, fair enough. So, but could appellant still seek a waiver?
Appellant could not. By statute, the waiver needs to be filed within 180 days of notice of the debt, and here that was in February 2015. Appellant, I believe, was represented by current counsel at that time, but did not file for a waiver, Your Honor.
So the appellant has argued that the board should have addressed whether the DIC payments being lowered in order to recoup this debt could constitute the reduction for purposes of conducting the analysis under 5112. First of all, do you know whether that argument was raised below?
Your Honor, I do not believe the argument was raised below in the notice of disagreement and the VA Form 9. Appellant argued that she was not at fault for creation of the debt, but she did not discuss the deductions to DIC. But I also, that doesn't really make sense that reductions to DIC would be a reduction to the accrued benefits. The accrued benefits have been paid. You received $91,000. What's being reduced, and as the court recognized in question four of its supplemental briefing order, was that it would be unrelated payments that are deducted in order to recoup the overpayment. So that occurs by statute 5314, and it doesn't have any effect on the accrued benefits that were already paid.
Could you respond to the appellant's argument about the M21-1 example that she asserts, the appellant asserts, shows that VA understands this to deal with a one-time payment that, do you know the one I'm talking about, the child issue?
I do, Your Honor. First, I would note that the M21 would not be relevant to the plain language argument that the Secretary is making. But to her specific M21 citation, that part of the M21 gives an example of an administrative error. And yes, if you input the wrong effective date for adding a beneficiary, that's an administrative error. But the next part of the M21, right under that, topic 3F, I believe, explains that when that type of error occurs, a notice to appellant goes out, and that notice states an overpayment may be created. So that part of the M21 doesn't say 5112 applies, no overpayment could be created when there is a one-time payment. It doesn't even use the term one-time payment. It just gives an example of an administrative error and recognizes that still an overpayment could occur in that circumstance.
I have a question. I don't know if you have your record in front of you, but there is a sort of odd, it seems an odd document. It's R-161 to 162. It's labeled Vets Net Compensation Pension Award. Do you see that?
Yes, Your Honor.
So we were just curious, net. People in my chambers were curious, not my colleagues on the bench here. What is that document?
So VetsNet is an accounting program, and so this appears to just be a screenshot of that program.
So is it only an internal document? Or is this like something that is then sent out to a veteran?
Your Honor, I do not believe this is, I'm not sure. I don't believe that this is something that's sent out. It appears to just be the accounting program that is used and the screen view.
Right, because it's sort of a confusing document in terms of what's being done, right? I mean, I don't know. I found it a little confusing.
I think this is just showing who the payee is and what the amount is for VA's accounting and financial purposes.
But as far as we know, this isn't something that's sent out to a claimant. This is,
as far as I know, this is not sent out, Your Honor.
So, Ms. Gruenberg, what would you have the court do in this case?
I would have the court determine that 5112 does not apply to a one-time payment scenario and thus affirm the board's decision in this matter, Your Honor.
That kind of goes back to my question regarding putting on your future thinking hat and whether or not, if the statute said it didn't apply, wouldn't that be an easier fix in some respects? I mean, legislatively?
Well, I believe it would certainly be an easier question for the court, and perhaps it would not be here if it's used the phrase one-time payment.
Right.
But looking to the terms it does use, reductions, discontinuances, and it discusses changes of awards. So considering the plain language of the statute and the legislative history, we believe it's clear that this does apply to running awards. If there are no further questions.
Anything else?
No. Thank you.
Your Honors, if I may go back to one point of discussion, which was that VA agrees that this section of the statute would apply if there was a running award. So if we were to change the facts of this case and say that the veteran had not died, and VA had determined that he was entitled to these benefits, but they had erroneously paid him any amount of a retroactive award, then under those facts, then, and using VA's standard, then provided there was sole administrative error, then in that circumstance, VA would not create an overpayment. They would and would not recoup any benefit from the veteran. In this case, the only thing that's different is that the veterans died.
Could I ask a question? I have two questions. First, when was your firm paid?
You're going to have to forgive me, Your Honor. I do not know that information off the top of my head, but I would be happy to look into that and provide the court with some supplemental information.
So, okay, fair enough. Second, why did you not seek a waiver?
We don't believe that that's the appropriate relief in this case.
Well, that was just crazy then, right? I mean, you maybe you're right. Maybe your client wins on this. But you just didn't seek a waiver at all? I mean, it was a conscious choice to say, you know, we're putting all our Easter eggs in this basket? I mean, that just, I have to tell you that, and I mean this with all niceness, but this client was not treated well. They weren't treated well by the VA, I think. They made a mistake, right? It baffles me why you did not seek a waiver. You've got your money, right? I mean, I hope that your firm, which I respect, thinks about whether or not, given the fact that you let the waiver issue go, and you apparently did it consciously, and you've got a check, it doesn't take a rocket science to figure out how the veteran or the claimant is served well here, because I do not understand why you wouldn't have sought a waiver as even a backup.
I can certainly appreciate what you're saying, Your Honor, and hindsight is 20/20 on some of those matters, but we submit that waiver is not the appropriate remedy for this case. It's not the appropriate relief to request, because the fact that there was an error made on this case is truly the result of sole administrative error, and I don't think that an appellant, any claimant, should be subjected to having to go through a waiver analysis when the error is so clear. Why should they have to demonstrate that there would be undue hardship or go through a balancing of faults analysis when there are no faults to balance?
Well, I wouldn't say, I mean, I have to tell you, I don't think it's clear. Your client may end up winning this case, right? But you've got three federal judges, three law clerks put a huge amount of time into trying to figure out whether it's right. So, I mean, right, this is not just sort of a no-brainer, I think, on this.
I mean, I apologize if I gave that impression that it's a no-brainer. But obviously, our position is that we do feel as if there's sole administrative error here. I mean, our client did not have any knowledge of the actual amount that she was to be paid, and it was not clear, especially to us, the amount that she was paid. And she was not given any notice of this.
What does that mean? It wasn't clear to you the amount she was paid?
Well, attorneys are not provided with a receipt or some kind of notice as to the amount or when an appellant is necessarily paid. So
are you telling me that you did not know that she received roughly $91,000?
We certainly were not aware of the amount that she was paid at the time that we were following up with VA for weeks following this decision to discuss whether attorney's fees had been withheld, and we were told that they were working on this matter. So it's not as if we had any reason to believe, either from the notice or from our communications with VA, that they had in fact not withheld our attorney's fees. And I also believe too that in this situation again, the withholding of attorney's fees is something that the VA in its own regulations has been asked to do. And if what the Secretary is proposing is accepted, then essentially VA can pass this burden on to the client and to the attorneys of ensuring not only that the calculations are correct and that deficient notice somehow cues them into the fact that attorney's fees were withheld, and it passes that burden along to them, which is not what's intended to happen. And I think, again, going back to the situation where if in this case the veteran had lived, this section were to apply, then the only factual difference here is that the veteran has died. And it seems as if VA is carving out an exception for widows and for dependent children to say it's going to make it even more difficult for them to avoid recovery of an overpayment simply because this one-time payment is not contemplated by the statute, when that's not what Congress intended. As well, to get back to your point about isn't the error in the actual award, and is there not a differentiation?
Counsel, your time has expired. Would you like to conclude?
What we are asking for in this case is for the court to find that Congress intended for the statute to apply in instances where a claimant with no knowledge or fault of the error and which resulted in an erroneous overpayment, that in this very limited circumstance, that an overpayment should not be created. We are not arguing that every time that VA makes a mistake, that the claimant should get to benefit from that error. Rather, what we are arguing is that when a claimant bears no fault and has no knowledge of the error, that VA is unable to recoup that erroneous payment, and that further an application of the statute in this manner does not result in an absurd outcome or place any undue burden on VA, but rather it would discourage perpetuation of erroneous actions and afford equal protection to recipients of all VA benefits.
Thank you. Thank you. The case will be submitted for consideration. The court will now come down and greet counsel.